This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A couple of weeks ago on the program, I was talking about the anniversary of the invasion of Ukraine, along with the historian Stephen Kotkin. And he said something that really struck me, that Vladimir Putin is destroying both countries, Ukraine and Russia. The horrifying campaign against Ukraine began a year ago. But for quite a long time, Putin had been dismantling Russia's civil society and, with it, its international reputation, and really its long-term economic prospects. One of the darkest moments along this path came in 2020, with the poisoning, the attempted murder of Alexei Navalny. Navalny is a prominent dissident and opposition leader, and he and a team of investigators illustrated in startling detail the corruption of Putin himself and his circle of aides and oligarchs. For his efforts, Navalny was poisoned with a nerve agent called Novichok, which was almost certainly done by the FSB, the security services. He survived the attack, and he's now being held in a Russian penal colony. If Russia has a future after this disastrous time, Alexei Navalny may well be pivotal to it. One of his closest colleagues is Maria Pevchik. Pevchik helps to run his anti-corruption foundation, and she's the head of investigations and media. She also served as an executive producer of the documentary called Navalny, which is nominated for an Academy Award. So, Maria, as anyone who has seen the documentary film Navalny knows, you are a very close comrade in arms with Alexei Navalny. You're an investigator. You speak to the public. You're an advisor. I'd like to begin simply by asking, you were a sociology student at Moscow State University. You were working in what you once described as the most boring job in the world, both in Moscow and London for a tobacco company. How did you meet Navalny, and why did you decide to join an enterprise like this, which is part journalistic, part activist, part political?
Well, I studied politics at London School of Economics. So from very early Putin's years, from his first term, it was very, very visible to me that something is going awfully wrong. So I was looking for an outlet. I was looking for some sort of force that I could join and help this force along the way to move forward. And Navalny seemed like a great option, who is most likely to be able to deliver change.
So what did Navalny represent to you in terms of a political ideology or opportunity?
Navalny represented a real person in politics. It was so new and so fresh back in the day because we were brainwashed from as long as I can remember myself, we were brainwashed at the university and school levels that there is no politics. You shouldn't be involved. Your vote doesn't change anything. You're not deciding anything. Leave this for the, you know, big guys. Or another one, politics is dirty. Mm-hmm. The only way to be political, you can be some sort of political strategist and make big money out of political campaigns. So political participation back then wasn't cool. It was great and cool to be apolitical. People were almost bragging about it.
But that was also what politics depended on. In other words, that's what Putin depended on. The deal of society was, you can pursue this new shining possible prosperity, at least if you were lucky enough to be in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and a few other places, and not in the provinces, but stay the hell out of politics. And if you entered politics, trouble will come your way, as so many journalists and budding politicians discovered to their peril.
Correct. And then there was Navalny, who was young, who was so good at putting complex things in simple words. The way that he wrote about corruption, about financial crimes. Now, this is a rather boring topic, isn't it? But the way that he was phrasing things, the way that he was framing that debate was so attractive. He could interest anybody in the topic, which normally isn't really interesting. But Navalny's charisma, Navalny's conviction, and just his ability to organize people around him, that definitely worked its magic. And we saw it on a larger scale just 2 years later in 2013 when he ran for mayor of Moscow. So essentially what worked for me back in 2011 was displayed on a larger scale in 2013 when we saw thousands and thousands of Moscovites like leaving their day jobs, good day jobs, to go and stand in front of a Navalny branded poster that said vote for Navalny as a mayor of Moscow. Those guys had, I don't know, they worked in big international consulting firms and investment banks, but in the evening they would show up at our headquarters and sort out leaflets like in four separate piles. Like that would be their assignment, and they would spend their evening volunteering with the most basic tasks at our headquarters.
And the regime was tolerating this. There was still some allowance for dissent, at least for a while.
Correct. But I think that what infuriated Putin and what eventually led Putin to the decision to kill Navalny is the fact that whatever Navalny did, being investigations or political activity or like running a campaign, that it worked and it attracted an audience that Putin assumed was his. Navalny's weight has changed a lot in 2017 when he started touring around Russia for campaigning to be allowed to run for the presidential elections in 2018. And this was when the biggest myth about Navalny was busted, that Navalny is for Moscovites, that Navalny is for this middle class, upper middle class guys, well-off people from St. Petersburg, Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And then Navalny started traveling the country, organizing those rallies in, I don't know, 80, 90 different cities and tiny little towns. Sometimes we would only be allowed to have this rally organized like on the outskirts, like literally in the middle of a forest next to a cemetery. And people still showed up. And whoever is responsible for internal politics in Kremlin, they realized, shit, even the people who we thought are the core Putin voters, they like Navalny. They show up. They go in the middle of the winter when it's minus 35 degrees. They go just to listen to the guy speaking from the stage.
At what point did Navalny and your team get the sense that they would no longer be tolerated and Navalny's life was in danger?
Every time when I heard Navalny giving an interview, I was sat right outside his office and I could overhear many journalists coming in and out. And I don't think there was one interview where he wasn't asked, how come you're still alive? How come they still haven't killed you? And I clearly still remember Navalny's face, rolling his eyes, saying like, guys, like, I don't know. I'm tired of this question. Stop asking. I don't know why I'm still alive and why they haven't tried to assassinate me. I don't know why they have decided to do this when they did it in August 2020. Mm-hmm. We know from our investigation together with Bellingcat that they started planning this when Navalny started to travel Russia for the presidential campaign. So this is when the surveillance started. This is when the FSB operatives, together with the chemists and doctors, started to follow Navalny. Have they tried to do something before? Have they tried to poison him earlier? Maybe. Maybe it just didn't work.
I have to say, and I hope I don't mean this in any way derogatory. The attempt on Navalny's life, it brought to mind in an almost perverse way a James Bond movie where you're watching the movie, and instead of shooting James Bond very simply, they do things like dip him slowly into a pool of piranhas or something, just for the sake of the movie, obviously. Why go to all this crazy trouble of, you know, poisoning his underwear? Or it's like, it's not like anybody was going to be deceived on who was behind this killing.
Well, the plan was that they poison Navalny, he gets on the plane, the flight is rather long from Tomsk to Moscow, around 5 hours, probably more. That would be enough for him to pass out. And if the plane didn't do an emergency landing, he would have been dead like in the next 45 minutes to an hour. Forever and ever, this would have remained a mysterious death. They've had, by the time Navalny collapsed and by the time he was hospitalized in Omsk, they already had a ready, like a pre-made theory of what has happened. They were starting to say, every state-owned channel, every state-owned newspaper, they would say, oh, Navalny drank a lot the night before. Navalny partied a lot the night before. Alcohol, drugs, you name it. And within hours of the poisoning, they had a theory that it's either Navalny's health or it was me who poisoned him. And that was a big alternative plot as well, hugely promoted by the...
Tell me about that. What was the story about you trying to poison Navalny?
That's actually now, when the whole alcohol and drugs thing didn't really check out at all and nobody really believed it. Now, according to the Russian propaganda, the main theory that they share on for the Russian audience is that I poisoned him. I have a very clear association with the foreign states. I lived in the UK for most of my life, and nobody really knew what I'm doing, who I am. I was there on the trip. And also, as Bellingcat found out recently, the group of FSB operatives and the poisoners, they have separately followed me on the days when they didn't follow Navalny. I found pictures of myself from surveillance taken on the morning when I left Moscow to go to the airport to fly to Siberia. They were following me and not other members of our team. In the beginning of the trip, they weren't following Navalny, but they were following me. Their cell data shows that they showed up at my hotel 2 days before the poisoning.
So he gets to Germany, and viewers will see this in the really remarkable documentary film, Navalny. And he recovers, physically recovers, which is not easy, and then decides, and there seems to be no question about it, to return to Moscow. And I want to hear the calculation of returning to Moscow. He had to know that his arrest upon arrival was almost a sure thing. So talk to me about that discussion of returning to Moscow.
There was never a discussion. There was never a process of choosing and, waiting scenarios and, deliberating on that. One of the first things that Navalny said when he woke up from coma is that he is going home. He is a Russian politician. He has built his career and he gained his popularity by telling people that they shouldn't be afraid. How hypocritical would that be if you ask people to be brave, to be courageous, and then yourself, you make not the most courageous choice, right? So our only deliberations were around the topics of how to run the foundation, the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Without Navalny, we spent days and days discussing every scenario in case, I don't know, what happens if he's under house arrest? What happens if he is in prison for a couple of years? What happens if he's in prison forever? What happens if he gets killed? What happens if nothing happens, if Navalny is just free and goes peacefully and home directly from the airport?
Was the most likely scenario was that he would land at the airport and be arrested?
Yes, it was most likely. It wasn't for sure, though.
I'm surprised from time to time, talking to people who are well-connected to him, that he's able somehow from a prison colony to communicate to the world through Twitter that there are fairly reliable reports on the condition that he's in and the conditions in which he lives. Tell me how that works.
Navalny is currently being investigated. Well, actually, no, he's already in the process in the legal process of the next court case. So that legal status allows him to see and communicate with his lawyers, who, you know, can meet him and discuss anything from the defense strategy to the content of the actual case. So his lawyers are able to visit him regularly, and this is how we know how well he's doing. We know his general, you know, state of health.
Which is what?
We know whether he's...
What's the state of health?
Well, it's not good. He has been poisoned by a nerve agent, by a chemical weapon. The consequences of such poisoning are not known. Not many people survived.
The long-term consequences of the Novichok.
Because your entire system, your entire nerve system just shuts down completely and entirely. And then, thanks to the German doctors, they managed to restart it. He managed to come back to a sort of, you know, a decent state of health. He was exercising, he was doing his daily walks and all of that. But nobody knows how this actually affects a person long term. On top of this, I'm not sure how it's whether it's related to Novichok poisoning, but perhaps because it only started after that. Navalny started to have severe back problems, severe to an extent that at some point during the first months of his imprisonment, he stopped being able to walk.
Do you think Putin wants him to die in jail and sooner the better?
Oh, I think Putin wants him to suffer a lot first and then die in prison. Of course, he wants that.
In your late at night, when you're thinking about this, do you imagine for him that end or the opposite, the end, the resolution of Nelson Mandela, who's released into the light and comes into political life?
It took him
life.
A couple of years to be released, so no, I'm not dreaming about Nelson Mandela scenario either. It took them a little bit too long.
What do you think? You've been very accurate in some of your predictions over the period of time that we've been talking about. How do you see this playing out?
I try to convince myself just not to think through the scenario of Navalny being poisoned and killed in whatever way, in prison. I think this is a self-defense mechanism, I'll be honest, David. Mm-hmm. Like, I've lived through him dying in front of me once, and I didn't like that experience at all, and I don't want to come back to it. And I know exactly, like, how it felt. I remember these days during his poisoning very vividly, and this were the scariest days of my life by far. Mm. So I don't see much point in, you know, just sitting there dwelling and looking into darkness and say, like, oh, what would I do when he gets killed? What would I do? Can he be killed tomorrow? Yes. For what I know, he might be dead right now. We don't have a way of finding out until the next morning. But this is not how I operate. I like to operate under different assumptions. I genuinely think it is possible to get him out.
How do you see that happening? Considering the war in Ukraine, the mobilization of society, the militarization of Russian society, what possible motive would there be, I hate to say it, for Putin to make that decision?
All of this can play both as an advantage and a disadvantage for Navalny. The situation is so chaotic, specifically because of the war. Is the likelihood of Navalny being released when the war ends high? I think it's almost certain. I'm almost certain as well that any next president after Putin, even if it's the worst one you can imagine, even if it's Prigozhin from the Wagner Group, I'm sure that the next president would release Navalny.
Why?
I'm sure
Why?
That they Why? Release... Because it's a symbolic... It's an easy win, you know? It could be a condition, a mass release of political prisoners could be a condition for lifting some sanctions, mm-hmm. could be a part of any sort of, you know, peace talks and reparation talks and all of that process, post-war process that is inevitable. There are many, many scenarios.
Maria, in Soviet times, there were a whole tribe of people in Moscow, but beyond, who eventually became known as the people of the 60s, Шестидесятники. And they played an odd game. You know, they were both in the establishment and also saw themselves as, you know, children of the secret speech by Nikita Khrushchev in the post-Stalin era and hoping for reform. Think of them what you will, they became the pillars of a top-down revolution. What's happened now is a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people, who are in many ways the best and the brightest, have left the country. You've lived in the UK a long time. And the exile now has been enormous. And these are people who were the potential liberal forces and intelligentsia of not only Moscow, but many other places. First of all, will they return? And how do you feel about people that in your mind have compromised on the margins of their activity?
Well, there are two separate questions. Those, as with regards to those people who left, I feel, you know, like in the long term, I feel sad that they left, because I'm being realistic. I understand that not all of them will come back. Even when Russia is free of Putin and when Russia is in its post-war period. I think some of them will, probably most of them will return, but we will lose a good 20% of brightest, smartest people who have managed to quickly, you know, restart their lives abroad, find new jobs, start new businesses, and, you know, just start their life from scratch. I'm being realistic. Yes, they probably won't return. Mm-hmm. I will be personally convincing them. I will be asking them and I will be trying to make them return home and contribute to building the beautiful Russia of the future, right? But so I understand that perhaps I'm not convincing enough and some people will choose their new life. And as for the second part of your question, the people who compromised, I try not to judge or be too rude or too judgmental here. I'm sure that you can guess what I actually think about compromising with Putin's power, about being ignorant, about closing their eyes to, you know, to the facts, to what was happening to us, to the opposition, and just, you know, continuing to like run your theater or cultural center or something like that.
Or radio station.
All I'm saying here is that let's now all gather and draw a very simple conclusion. This strategy didn't work. They've lost the radio stations, the TV channels, and whatever they were trying to save, they lost. And along the way, they've lost the integrity and the honesty.
And I hate to go from the extremely serious to the seemingly banal. Your film is up for an award, an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it may well win. I'd like to see it win, quite frankly. And
no, me too.
And there will be a moment with the biggest audience imaginable with a couple of minutes, you thank your agent, you know, the usual thing. What do you want the world to know in the broadest sense?
From day one of Navalny's imprisonment, my main job alongside investigations is to climb on the highest mountain and scream and shout from the mountain top, Navalny, Navalny, free Navalny. That's literally the most important thing I can do. That's my way of trying to save his life. The Dolby Theater stage in Los Angeles, the venue where the Oscars are being held, that is the stage that the entire world will be watching during that evening. And it really doesn't matter whether you get to say something from the actual stage holding the little golden man or off the stage during the press conference. The attention is still there. And it is literally my job to grab that attention and to point it, not at myself, but at Navalny.
Maria Pevchik is a Russian activist and investigator. She's an executive producer of the documentary Navalny about the jailed opposition leader, which is nominated for an Academy Award, and it's streaming right now on HBO Max. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When they were just 13 and 11 years old, Chloe and Halle Bailey started posting videos of themselves singing on YouTube.
Hey, what's up, you guys? I'm Chloe.
And I'm Halle.
And you all have requested so many songs, and we want to thank you for that.
Yes.
But the one you all have requested the most was Rolling in the Deep by Adele. There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching all people, pitching, it's bringing me out the door.
Chloe and Halle. That's how they build themselves, quickly built a following. Their cover versions of other artists' songs often went viral. A cover of Beyoncé's Pretty Hurts caught the attention of Beyoncé herself.
Mama said, you're a pretty girl. It's in your hair. It doesn't matter. Brush your hair and fix your teeth. What you wear.
But Chloe and Halle were thinking a lot bigger than just going viral for a hot second. They wanted to build a career, and they did so, owing in part to Chloe's producing of their songs, something that's still pretty unusual for very young female artists.
I faked it for nothing. Can't talk to my friends, cause they hate you, do. And if the option's mindless, don't make me choose.
Beyoncé signed them to her management company and brought Chloe and Halle on tour as her opening act. Now, after two albums and five Grammy nominations, the sisters are for the very first time working on separate projects. Halle is starring as Ariel in an upcoming remake of The Little Mermaid, and Chloe is releasing a new solo album. It's called In Pieces, and it comes out later this month. Chloe Bailey spoke with our contributing writer, Lauren Michelle Jackson, at the New Yorker Festival in October.
What is that like going from duo to solo?
When I was creating with Halle, I always had her by my side and I could go, Halle, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? If I made a beat, I'll be like, do you like this? What about this lyric? And she'll be like, yeah, it's great. And she'd kind of give me that extra boost of confidence that I needed. And now, you know, creating is the same. I never stop creating because with our Chloe and Halle albums, I engineered and produced us and all of that. So doing it on... So doing it on my own, the confidence wasn't there because I was like, I don't have Halle by my side to tell me if it's good or not. So that has been interesting because that's where you really have to step into believing in yourself and believing that your art is good enough. So when I took up producing, I think at 12 years old, you know, Sis and I, we were singing all around Atlanta and there would be no producers who would take us seriously. And like, what kind of songs and tracks are you going to make for 10 and 12 year olds? You know, so it's not that hard to believe. And I was in the house and had my computer and I started looking up on YouTube how to produce and all of that. And it just kind of happened and flourished on its own. And I love building. I think that's why I love puzzles and Legos so much. That's really all producing is. And how I layer harmonies in my head, that's how I hear the full production. So I think that's why vocal producing comes so easily to me, because that's how I hear all the different instrumental parts.
I'm wondering if there are certain terms that sort of resonate with you when it comes to describing the genre of your work.
Yeah, if there's one word I'd have to put it into, I'd say unpredictable. I'm inspired by so many different random things, and I like to put that into my music. So when it comes to genres or labels or boxes, I just create how I'm feeling that day. You know, if my heart feels happy and excited and I really want to dance, you'll get a pop record. You know, if I'm feeling really moody and grungy and sad, you know, sometimes it'll be R&B, sometimes it'll be alternative. You never know what you're going to get, and I don't want people to ever be able to know what to expect from me. And I think that's why I'm so excited for whenever God wants the album to come out, when it comes out, so that you all can hear all of the different places I go to and the different vibes and the feel and the emotion. And I just kind of let my heart take the lead in what it's supposed to sound and feel like.
I really just kind of want to know the practice of the cover. What is like the selection process? You know, like not everyone gets a cover from Chloe Bailey, you know, like...
It's definitely based on how I'm feeling. I've sent so many covers, like, what about this one? What about this one? In group chats. And, you know, I think it comes down to, can I properly execute? Because I'm not trying to be dragged online as well. And there's been so many times I've redone covers. There's been so many that I haven't put out. There's been so many that I think will pop off and didn't. There's been so many where I didn't put that much thought into it and it got crazy, like so viral.
Feet on the ground, and she's burning it down. This girl is on fire.
I have a love-hate relationship with social media, because if we think about it, without social media, without YouTube, without covers, my sister and I would not be here. And when I was little, I'd always be like, I'm going to be a superstar. I don't know how, but I'm going to make it. So I'm still saying that to myself, but it's crazy that the beginning of the journey started through that. Before your songs had to pop off on TikTok, you know, it was YouTube and the radio and all that stuff. So no matter which generation we're in, there's always something that you want your music to like be like lit on, right? So I think when we program our minds to think about being number one and winning all these awards, when you're creating, it really suffocates you and it stifles the process. Yes, you have to have hit songs and popping singles or whatever. That's great, but you can't let it rule you. Right now, I'm just creating to be creating, and I have never felt more free when it has come to that. And that's when you get the magic. With Have Mercy, I'm going to be completely honest. I was pleasantly surprised how it popped off on TikTok, because I did not make that song for TikTok. When I created the song, I was really emotional that day, and I had this beat that my friend Murda sent me for like 2 weeks, and I was holding on to it because I really liked it, but I was like, I can't mess it up. I think something online was going about me and not the most positive space, and I was so sad about it. And Have Mercy was a response to everyone who had something negative to say about me expressing the freedom with my body. So, good songs. And, you know, I didn't know it was going to be so pop or, you know, or so tongue-in-cheek. I was saying a lot of things in those lyrics I would not say in everyday life. And who knew that just speaking from the heart, you create that. So I just have to constantly speak from the heart.
So now we have time for some Q&A. Let's see. This one's really cute. What advice do you have for siblings looking to produce together?
Oh, okay. Listen to each other. And if you have a disagreement on something, try it both ways and then listen to it and then take the vote then. There's been so many times Sis and I would butt heads on certain musical decisions on a song. Like, no, this way's better. No, this lyric's better. So we've learned to just try it both ways. Sometimes I'd be proven wrong. Sometimes she'd be proven wrong. And I think that's the best way to see if something works. So
this one asks, how much of your time is spent on vocal preservation / maintenance?
The vocal cords, it's like a muscle. So any athlete, you have to condition your body. You have to train. If you don't stretch, you pull a muscle, things like that. And I'm constantly trying to learn. I love hearing singers who are doing riffs and runs I cannot do. Plastic on the Sofa by Beyonce, that cover, it challenged me vocally, and I was grateful for it. It's like, thank you. It's like a fun puzzle. And it's like, once you get the riffs and runs right, you're like, yes. I say this a lot. It was at the opening of the African American Smithsonian Museum. And my sister and I were singing, and Mary Mary comes right after us, the next song. And I'm sure you guys know, I'm very open about it. No matter whenever I perform, I get really, really nervous, like shakes and everything. But I hope it never goes away, because one, it reminds me I'm alive. Two, it's like an adrenaline rush, and I think I kind of live for it. Like in the moment, even though I feel like I'm gonna faint sometimes, I'm like, oh Lord Jesus, help me. I'm like, oh wow, that was kind of exciting. It was a thrill. So it's like that, right? Hallie's always like, Chloe sis, we got this. We chill, right? That's Hallie. I'm over there freaking out. Yeah, Aries. Yeah, you know. And so they turned to us and they said, don't go out there trying to sing and prove yourself to anyone. Sing for God, sing to God, and everything else will fall into place.
That's Chloe Bailey speaking to Lauren Michelle Jackson at the New Yorker Festival. Her debut album, In Pieces, comes out this month. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Not long ago, I was hanging around the office and I came across the New Yorker's director of photography, Joanna Milter. And on a big desk, she was laying out a series of black and white images, one after another.
One of our story editors had forwarded an email to me from a man, Peter Cunningham, who claimed to have access to a cache of images that Henri Cartier-Bresson photographed in New Jersey in the 1970s. I thought, is this real? Like, could this be authentic? You know, I mean, Cartier-Bresson is one of the most famous documentary photographers of all time. His catalog is very well known, very famous. And how could there be this cache of unseen, unpublished images?
The scenes were very recognizable to me from my youth. Commuters stuck in a traffic jam near the George Washington Bridge, beauty salons, an office, huge sprawling power plants. These were terrific pictures by a French photographer who was really one of the masters of the form. And Henri Cartier-Bresson had chosen to shoot them all in my home state, in New Jersey.
It's a kind of shortcut through America in a way. Something where you find extremes. When we mention to anybody that we're doing an essay, that means concentrating on various aspects of New Jersey, they're always surprised. Why? But what's the interest? And it seems that they just go through on the turnpike, and it's all the industrial areas that they'd like to forget.
So the story of how Peter Cunningham came to have these prints in his possession is really interesting. In the 1970s, Peter told me, his girlfriend at the time was working as a producer at a public television station in New York.
Yeah, that's right. Working on a PBS show called Assignment America as an associate producer. She came home saying that she wanted to do a show on a photographer. And who should she do? Well, I said, well, you should get Henri Cartier-Bresson, but he'll never do it.
And so she invited Cartier-Bresson to the United States with the proposal that they make a documentary about him and that he create a body of work and that they make a documentary around that body of work.
When Jean came home and told me that Cartier-Bresson had said yes, I probably fell on the floor or jumped and touched the ceiling. It was unbelievable because Henri was and still is my hero.
And then Peter, who was a young photographer, burgeoning photographer at the time, ended up with the assignment to be his assistant.
We drove out of the city every day and yakked away in the car all the way and drove all the way back and yakked all the way back. It was only when we were in the process of shooting that Henri didn't want to talk. And he my job was to make all the interactions, to speak with people, and allow him to be completely, to be himself in the frame. He loved living in the frame of his Leica.
So who would decide where to go, and what was the conception behind it all?
Jean Evans in the studio at PBS at Channel 13 did the production. So she booked us every day somewhere with the Newark Fire Department or with a nuclear power plant or with the State House in Trenton or this and that. So she planned our targets.
Now, as I remember, Cartier-Bresson used to talk about the decisive moment, capturing the decisive moment. That was what it was all about for him. How did you see that in action?
The decisive moment. What one thing he told me, I never connected until you mentioned it, David, is that he would say to don't see what's happening now, see what's about to happen. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, focus your eyes a second or two in advance of the present tense, which is unusual kind of advice. We are all told to live in the present. Well, he's actually living a second or two before the present.
He's anticipating.
I think that's right, David.
And did you see him? Was there any moment, any photograph that you can recall? You said, now I see what he's up to.
Here, I'll show. They're mounted on board for the TV production. But it's this picture of Governor Brendan Byrne boxing with Jersey Joe Walcott. And Jersey Joe has a checkered suit on. And I guess PR kind of guy in the background has the same checkered suit by coincidence, I'm sure. And this was a press event. There were other photographers there, but he maybe shot. I have to look at the contact sheets, but he got maybe shot, I don't know, 10 frames. He didn't overshoot like we do now with our digital cameras.
Right.
Where there's no limit. It used to cost us 35 cents each time we pressed the shutter, but now there's
now
no price on it. Yeah,
yeah,
it is, and it changes. It changes the way we do things. What he did shoot, some of the pictures were more interesting than others, but every single one of them was beautifully composed, down to the little black corner in the black shape in the corner.
It's so true. He says, at one point, Cartier-Bresson says, in photography, the smallest thing can be a great subject. The little human detail can become a leitmotif.
So Henri said that he wanted to show Americans or New Jersey people their own culture. He said that it's very difficult to see a culture from in if you're a part of it. It's like being, you know, a fish in water that doesn't see the water. So this picture, which is pretty ordinary, really strikes me as an example of that because at the time, I don't remember, but I probably thought nothing of a guy standing over what we called a girl at the time and supervising her. It was a boss and a secretary. Mm. We don't have bosses and secretaries anymore.
So what we're seeing here is a woman at an office seated, and she's going through some papers, and hovering above her is what, because of the time, we presume to be her supervisor or her boss, who's a male.
She looks a little scared, doesn't she? As if she can't maybe find the thing the boss is looking for.
It does look almost, the office looks incredibly, deliberately lifeless. I mean, it's just cold and endlessly white, and you would not want to spend that much time in that room, much less 40 hours a week.
One thing I learned from Henri's work as a youngster was that this was the power of the still photograph, that even more than a narrative form, the still photograph could reflect reality in ways that worked like a metaphor in the receiver's mind so that they kind of exploded with meaning.
Can you give us an example of any of the photographs where you think that's the case?
Yeah, okay, here we are. So this is the picture that you, David, thank you, featured as the lead picture in your piece. It's a picture from a beauty school in Central Jersey. Mm-hmm. And there's a person is making up another person, but he put himself in a mirror, in the corner of a mirror.
Right, you can see in the lower right hand corner of the photograph. You have a photograph in which one woman is making up another, but it's also about photography. It's about looking, and so in the lower left hand quadrant of this photograph, you see Henri Cartier-Bresson taking the photograph. This is as we now say these days endlessly, a meta picture, a picture about taking pictures, capturing an image and all the rest. It's really quite remarkable.
Yeah. Before I worked with Henri, I used to work in that style, black and white style on the street. And afterwards, I realized if I spent my whole life doing this, I could once in a while get a picture of his standard, but I couldn't ever achieve his level of consistent excellence. So I switched to color film and to a different thing, to doing juxtapositions of images. I consciously changed because he was so good.
He seems so ambivalent about his own art. And said, in fact, he would never use a flash, as far as I understand. And he said that using a flash was impolite, like coming to a concert with a pistol in your hand.
Well, I completely agree. I've been a performance photographer my whole life, and it is. It's a horrible thing to use a flash. It makes the photographer be the center of the action. And in a concert hall, the person on stage is the center of the action.
Now, tell me what resulted from all these photographs. What was put on television at the time in the mid-70s?
Oh, gosh, David, that's a sad story. So there was a problem with the production in that the director insisted on doing it his way, despite knowing that Henri's preferences, he cropped the pictures for TV in TV format, which is whatever it is, 4x5. So the show aired with the pictures cropped, which is a sin. It was a horrible scene.
And so Cartier-Bresson must have been furious.
I was never aware of his personal reaction. He was always friendly with us afterwards. He kept writing postcards and inviting us to visit. But his agent went crazy. And
that's what agents are for.
Well, she did a good job. Yeah. So all history of the New Jersey event disappeared. So in the timeline of Henri's career, photographing in New Jersey doesn't exist. It's not there. It was written out of history.
And then you hung on to these prints and then finally brought them to the New Yorker.
Well, yeah, I protected them for all those times, and I was a busy photographer myself, so I didn't pay much attention that they were on my shelves gathering dust for literally 48 years. And I'm very grateful that the New Yorker picked them up, because as Henri's assistant, being an assistant is sometimes like a love affair. The love affair can end, but you still have a kind of essence of love for somebody a whole life. And that's what I feel with Henri. I'm still his servant, and I would like to do what I imagine he would like. And in this case, I'd like to have the people of New Jersey be able to see the pictures he made of their state nearly 50 years ago.
Peter Cunningham is a photographer himself based in Massachusetts, and you can see Henri Cartier-Bresson's photographs of New Jersey at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Baltin, Frida Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.